You are listening to station WGN.
Oh, a microphone.
And a phony at the mic.
Yes. Oh.
And radio became an accepted vehicle for nationwide news and opinion.
Notify all radio and TV stations to broadcast the following message.
Oh, is that the comedy spot?
No, Bubblehead, this is a comedy spot.
You're a fun guy, Dave. You're lonely on an island.
What a dope. What a maroon.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is exciting, isn't it?
5, 4, 3, 2.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's Dave Plyer here on 720 WGN. Very happy you could join us on this Saturday night, early Sunday morning, 312-981-7200. Good morning, Mr. Roger Badish.
And good morning. Happy Father's Day to you.
Same to you, my friend. Same to you.
All the other fathers, and including the mothers who act as fathers.
That's a great point. I like that. I like that.
So,
how's your Sunday going so far, my friend?
Going very good. We did an early Father's Day yesterday. Went up to the Iron Horse. Great place up on Northwest Highway. Not that Iron Horse.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Another Iron Horse you could bring kids to.
Okay.
And it's a pretty cool place because, you know, they make some great pizzas up there. And they allow the kids to come up and knead the dough and flatten it out and make their own pizza dough.
Nice.
Which is pretty cool. So the kids like that. And it's a lot of gluten-free stuff there. We had a good time, and I got some really nice handmade cards from the grand
girls. Those are the best, aren't they?
They're fantastic.
Fabulous.
And then I got a great card from my wife, which contained a dancing squirrel with a hula hoop wearing underpants, dancing to the theme of Yakety Yak, the sax.
So wow.
That was... Very strange card. Got some nice stuff from the kids,
cool.
A movie and dinner, because you know where my daughter works now?
What's that?
This is going to be cool. She now works for Rub Barbecue.
Oh, yeah, you told me that. Yeah.
And she just finished her first week there.
Cool.
And so we got a nice gift card for a little dinner. And then Rufus gave me a card after I got home.
Nice.
Yeah.
Look at that. And I got to tell you, joining us tonight also, first show on the Dave Plyer Show, you heard her last night if you listened to Matt Bubala, is Camille. Camille, good morning to you.
Good morning. What's happening? Happy to be here.
I am thrilled that you are here as well. It's a first show, and it's a first show that we have, like, a full audience in here. We've got a full crew in here, including my my son, Josh, who is joining us. He joined us on Father's Day last year. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, Dad.
What's going on, buddy?
Not much.
So Josh is going to hang out with me all night long, which is very cool. He took a little nap before the big show and participate. He's also going to do the sportscast on the bottom of the half hour, and handling the top of the half hour is my nephew, Ben Picorni. Ben, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Uncle Dave.
How's it going, buddy? Happy,
not too bad.
Happy Sunday to you. And his dad, who's our resident pop culture historian who joins us now and then, is Kevin Picorni. Good morning, Kev.
Good morning, Dave. Happy to be here with you.
Happy Father's Day to you, buddy.
Thank you, and to you also.
Absolutely. We thought we'd talk a little bit about baseball. It's always a conversation that we have as a family. And as I've mentioned before, my son Josh is now working at Wrigley Field. When was do you guys remember, and I'm going to start with Kev, your first Cubs game. Do you ever remember really when that was?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
See, because I don't remember. I know I know when I used to go with my grandpa and stuff, but when was the first?
My grandfather took us, and it was part of it was a group of people from St. Raymond's, St. Raymond's Church in Mount Prospect. We're going to a Cub game. We loaded up on the yellow school buses and went down.
Oh, okay. All right. We used to do that with the Knights of Columbus to the Illini games with my grandfather.
It was a little different.
It was a little different, yeah. The guys would, there'd be the butcher would be on. He'd bring all the ham sandwiches, and then the guy who owned the bar brought all the beer, and they'd be really lively on the way up.
Some sort of dice game going
on
the back.
Yeah. And then on the way home, everyone was sleeping except, like, me. And a couple of the other grandkids were like, what happened, everybody? They're all passed out. For me, you know, I just know we went in all the time with my grandfather in the 70s. For some reason, he loved Pittsburgh when they played Pittsburgh. So we'd always go. That would be our first game of the year. And then we'd always go to Chinatown for dinner. Like, that was tradition.
What a neatly woven memory.
Yeah.
Can't think of the Cubs without Chinatown. Well, how many people have said
that? We go to Gale Street after Cubs games, so I think there's, you know, some tradition in that. Do you remember your first Cubs game, Josh?
My youngest Cubs game I remember is sitting on that, like, the third base, or no, first base side.
Okay.
With my knees banged up.
Okay.
That was about it. I got a first pit or a foul ball thrown to me.
It was a Mets game.
Yeah.
It was Mike Piazza who threw him the ball. No, you were actually either two or you were really young at this game, and you got the ball thrown to you, and we were just maybe a row or two behind the dugout, and as soon as Josh got the ball, and again, 2 or 3 years old, he was ready to throw it back.
Of course. Huck it back
and everybody in the audience around was like, yeah, in slow motion. No, don't throw the ball back.
Piazza now, he's like top five catchers of all time.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a valuable ball.
Yeah. I do also remember, and I appreciate this, and I would say 90% of the Wrigley Field games, that, you know, there's people that are pretty lit up sometimes, and they're drinking, and they're swearing. And as soon as they see my kids...
I apologize for that, by the way, Dave.
Yeah, exactly. But as soon as they see it, they apologize, or they keep themselves in check because of that, too. Ben, how about your first game?
I can remember sitting with my dad down the left field line, upper deck. I was probably about 3 or 4.
Last week?
Yeah. Probably about 3 or 4.
Yeah.
And before a lot of the major renovations had been done at Wrigley, so it was just bare bones, old school.
Oh, of course.
And we were the last row all the way down the left field line, right up against the fence.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So you could see all the... I remember watching the... I might have been more interested in the kids playing in the fire hydrants outside the fire station there instead of watching the
game.
That's
part of the experience.
Something that Ben might not remember, and it's my whenever I talk about taking Ben to his first game, it can almost make me tear up. He's so little at the time that I had him on my shoulders.
Oh yeah,
I'm walking through the bowels of the building, and
best way to get through with a little kid, actually.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Otherwise, I have to tether him somewhere.
Yeah.
So we got there early enough. We can walk around a little bit, and I went down by the lower box seats. I had him on my shoulders, and I'm coming up the stairs, and I get still to this day, you know, I'm almost 50 years old, and I still get chills the first time I walk out every season. And I walk to the top of the stairs, and I hear Ben up on my shoulders, and I hear, you know, I'm taking in the vista, and I completely forgot that I had this 4-year-old on my shoulders, and this is what I hear: "Dad, wow,
oh, that's cool."
And it was perfect.
Yeah,
it's perfect.
That is very cool. That is very cool. Now, I think, by the way, I did mention my grandfather. My father was always at those games too. My grandpa took us both to those games. Roger, do you remember your first game? Was it when the Cubs were playing at Wrigley or the other
field?
It
was called Wigan Park.
Actually, we watched the construction.
Chicago Whales.
We helped shovel some of the dirt out of the way. Yeah.
It was in the Federalist League.
Yeah, we followed the horse and buggy over from the Southside Field.
I'm sorry. It's your birthday next week. I gave you some crap.
It's fine.
All right.
My first, I can't vividly remember my first trip to Wrigley Field. Yeah. I grew up in Evanston, so pretty much we went to Wrigley because it was convenient. Though my father was a Sox fan.
Okay. All right.
So my mother, because they had Ladies' Day, so growing up, my mother would always... take me to Ladies' Day with her. And because it was so inexpensive, and she loved the Cubs. And I remember times where my brother and I, he was 6 years older than me, so he would be in charge of me going over to the Howard L station, the Red Line, and taking the train in and catching a few Cubs games. But I think one of the earlier ones was a family trip. My dad sold insurance for decades with Metropolitan Life, and they always had a company outing. And I remember them going to Wrigley Field, and I do remember one of the highlights was Dad gets a beer, and I got to sample the foam.
Oh, look at that. That's nice. Cool.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
That's
and the warning cool. always was, don't drink past the foam.
Gotcha.
What does he know?
Gotcha.
So, but yeah, those were the early days, and eating like everything Frosty malts.
Sure.
Bags of salted peanuts.
Oh, yeah.
Cotton candy. Three or four hot dogs.
But it's all experiences with your dad.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I know this is the first Father's Day without dad, so we'll raise a glass to him a little bit later, of course.
Sounds good.
Absolutely. Camille, and this is why we have a breaking up of all the guys in this room. So how about you? First baseball game, what do you remember?
So I don't remember my first Cubs game, but one of the ones that comes to mind, I think I was in, like, preschool, first grade. Me and my best friend were still best friends.
That's cool.
Our dads took us to a game. And I have pictures of us in big pink puffy coats. It must have been like a really cold spring day.
Yeah, okay.
With Cubs hats on.
April
and
or something, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a big, you know, we're standing outside of that Wrigley sign right on like Clark
the
there.
Marquee, yeah.
Yeah, and it says like, you know, Sammy hits whatever. That was okay. When he was in the home run race.
Sounds right,
so,
yeah. So you remember that, but it's with Dad.
Yep.
Yeah, it's with Dad on this Father's Day. I love hearing that. Now, Josh is working at Wrigley. That's that experience has to be pretty incredible.
Oh, it's
talk about it all the time.
It's not even a job. Oh, yeah.
No, yes.
It's awesome. I love it.
We're living vicariously through you. But when you come home from work, I'm usually up because I feed you because you're ravenous.
At 11.
At 11, 11:30, whatever it is. But you got stories to tell every game.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Which is very cool because you meet some interesting people.
Oh, yeah, it's all socializing. It's all meeting people and greeting and making sure everyone's smiling and handing out stickers. That's the best part, handing out stickers.
Yeah.
To little kids.
I bet.
Best thing.
And they have secret shoppers at every game that are looking at every position, and they've got a bunch of them out there. So you know when you're being, you know, sometimes it'll come up to you because they'll give you a coin.
Yeah, no, we get our marquee moments tokens.
No.
Supervisors give out like a couple per game, per gate, and they'll spot you out for doing some nice things. Or you can get them for fan letters that you can receive, or just any kind of like great act of just consideration, or you're doing something kind, or just you're meeting someone, you're helping them out, and you get a token. And then at the end of the year, you collect your token, see how many you get, and you can receive some type of prize.
But I love that because that says that they really want that experience for everybody who goes to the ballpark to be special.
Oh, yeah.
And they're checking on everybody. And if you're not cutting it, you're not coming back, or you're not going to be scheduled.
Every week we have a number of fan letters for marquee moments, like specifically from fans, either quoting GSA or some type of personnel working there, or just in general their experience and how great it was, and we get to read them every week, and it's great.
What's the official title of your job?
Guest Services Ambassador.
And I from what I understand, how many young folks like yourselves applied for this, and how many wound up receiving a position?
There's quite a lot. I mean, a lot of people. I mean, there are people
thousands for a few hundred.
Oh yeah,
positions.
A couple hundred.
Wow.
I think. Yeah.
Fantastic.
In March, but no, people went from GSA. They went for security. They went for ADA, which is also something I'm doing, which is helping out the physically disabled, like helping them out, asking them if they want a wheelchair, and then we push them to their seats. We ask them their name, their seat number, and aisle and row. And at the end of the game, we come pick them up, and it's fun.
Fantastic.
Yeah, because you create a relationship from the beginning of the game.
Oh, yeah.
And they're waiting for you at the end to get them out of their holders.
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. All right, what do we think about, and I've noticed this at every game, and I'm absolutely loving this, is Cubs dancing bullpen.
The best.
Oh, no, I think...
Right?
But
of course.
I think they were looking for something. I know they've said this before. It was when the bullpens were out in left and right field, just in the middle out there, you had the fan interaction. You had the ability to be involved in the atmosphere in the park.
Of course.
So they like to create their own little atmosphere in the bullpen underneath the stadium. They want to be a part of what's going on in the field.
It still connects to the fans.
Yeah. Yeah. That's their way to be involved.
Really, the only thing as a fan in the stadium, the only interaction you now have with them is that one of the scoreboard lights will show up to tell you who's warming up in the bullpen
at that time. Right,
otherwise...
Right.
I do miss that. I miss being able to look down my app. Yeah, he's taking his jacket off. Here he goes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We don't have that. But.
You gave up a little bit for a tremendous ballpark experience with the park and everything else.
Oh, yeah.
Now.
Sure.
I mean, that's amazing. If you haven't been there, folks, yet, I mean, they pretty much blew out half a side of the field to create a new gate that goes out into the park, and it is just such a... Just a beautiful experience.
Yep.
Yeah.
At the opening night game against the Dodgers when I went before the game,
He was there with his father.
and Josh was working.
They had everyone out. We were getting up to the game and everyone was standing out in the lawn. I'm sure if you've been there, the lawn right by the new Cubs store, which is a great, really cool store.
Yeah.
and they have the big video board up there, and they were replaying Game 7.
Oh, that's cool.
On the video board.
Yeah. How cool
before that was opening really cool. night.
I was getting emotional.
Reliving the experience with everyone there, and yep. I think it rivaled when Josh and I, we were at the Cubs victory celebration, the rally in Grant Park.
Yeah. That was
front
great.
Row for that, and yeah. they played the game up there again, and it was just a shared experience with everyone that you didn't get to feel maybe at home, and it was cool to see.
They're playing a movie in the park there. Was it this weekend, or is it next?
Well, they've got movies in the park playing all throughout summer, but the one I'm looking forward to is July 14th, and they're playing Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Which there won't be a crowd there at all. You'll be able to get right in there.
Yeah,
you'll be able to get right in there. Well, that's the cool part. Even like on non-game days, that place is open. I mean, anyone can sit there and relax and take kids there and stuff.
Here's one thing that always amazes me. What is the capacity of the ballpark?
Capacity of Wrigley Field is 41,268 fans.
Okay, and what's the average game?
Attended? Average home game is about 38,740.
Okay, what's the biggest attendance for a game? Is it the Dodgers? What is it?
It's the LA Dodgers for Dodger Stadium. They have their capacity is 56,000,
wow.
like even.
That's crazy.
So you can't compare. It depends on, you really got to look at the ratio of how many people can fit in the ballpark versus how many attend every game.
And the popularity itself, or the game's popularity.
Who's the worst team?
Worst team would be Tropicana Field.
Tampa Bay.
Tampa Bay Rays.
Every time I see a game of Tampa Bay, when I say there's nobody there, it seems like there's a couple thousand people in the whole stadium.
Right. Single digits in the thousands that are there at the game.
That's terribly sad. Yeah.
Joe Maddon, a couple years ago when he was back managing for Tampa Bay, they were in a pennant race in the AL East with the Red Sox, and they were playing the Red Sox at home, four games left in the season, trying to get into the playoffs, and they were 12,000 people in the stands.
Oh, man, that's sad. Yeah. That's a horrible thing. Looking at how the Cubs measure up to the World Series champs of last year, what's their record been at home? Versus on the road?
This year at home compared to last year, or this year at home in general?
Let's give me both. Give me a comparison.
This year the Cubs, after yesterday's loss, they're 33 and 34.
Okay.
Overall, so just playing under 500. On the road this year, 13 and 19, and at home 20 and 15. So the road and home numbers. You can obviously see a very big discrepancy in how they're playing at home and on the road.
Of course. Yeah.
And the last 10 games for the Cubs, won 3 of their last 10, lost 7 of their last 10.
Wow. Not good.
No.
Not good. A little different. A little different.
We're just grateful we're in the worst division in baseball right now, so we can keep our heads above water.
And we have some, who's hitting kind of below their average right now?
So five of the Cubs starters hitting below average, and you look at Wilson Contreras batting .246, Javi Baez .240, Zobrist, the World Series MVP batting just .223, and probably the one player drawing the most criticism from his performance this year, Kyle Schwarber batting .174.
Wow.
But it is amazing the support that he still gets.
Oh, no, of course.
The fans love this guy,
and
they want so badly for him to do well.
Oh, yeah. His hustle in left field is incredible. I mean, he's all over, but he's a little bit slower this year.
I don't usually agree with a lot of the pundits on MLB Network. I don't know if anyone watched Chris Russo hot take, and he's been saying that Kyle Schwarber this, Kyle Schwarber that. He was making a statement the other day saying that Kyle Schwarber's a player made for the American League, and I think that he is a player made for the American League. He's a natural hitter. He doesn't move as great as many other left fielders might. He's not a solid catching position player. So one thing to keep in mind is that he's playing out of position a lot and also picking up a lot of offensive slack. He's doing a great job for the situation he's in.
But you still can't be going to a game. And I love that this conversation actually came out of, just dads going to the baseball game. And that's what it's all
about.
That's
it.
Oh, yeah. We got to take a quick break. Let me tell you a little bit about what's on the show. After the break, we're going to talk about the best and worst TV dads of all time. So I want to hear your thoughts on that, too, out there. 312-981-7200. And I did mention in the preview that, there's some people in the rankings that obviously still rank the Cosby Show up there because the show itself was such a great show. And you got to think about all the other cast members that spent all that time in the show, and the writers and the producers and everyone behind the scenes. Great show. How do you separate the man from the series and look at the series itself as a great TV dad. It's a little difficult. Love to hear your thoughts on that, too. But best TV dads of all times, whether it's the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and today, 312-981-7200. We're also going to talk about retro beers. You know, there's some beers that have completely skipped a generation, the Schlitzes, the PBRs, that that really college kids are drinking now, and they skipped some of us. So we're going to talk about that after the news at 3 o'clock. Mike Love from the Beach Boys at 3:30. A couple of great conversations we're going to have. Number one with Dr. Craig Garfield from Northwestern University about the changing role of the modern dad compared to what it was decades ago, and how involved dads are obviously today compared to maybe some of our dads that, you know, were outside of the home. Women worked inside the home. It's very different now, obviously. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And there was a great Time magazine article about the Catholic Church across the country, that there's this new millennial wave of priests that are hitting the churches, and what they're doing to make a change and really create some long-lasting relationships and make sure the church is around for a long time. And we'll do that at 4:20. This is History. Roger's going to fill in for Dave on that. And that and much more coming up next. It's a Father's Day show. My son Josh here, my nephew Ben, and Kevin Picorni joining us live in studio. And there's more next on 720 WGN.
Time now for WGN Sports. Here's Josh Plyer.
Thanks, Roger. The Cubs fell in Pittsburgh 4-3. Jake Arrieta took the loss despite striking out seven Pirates. Arrieta also cranked a two-run bomb at the plate. Addison Russell hit his sixth homer. Cubs will finish their three-game series tomorrow in Philadelphia at 12:35 p.m. The White Sox won their second series game against the Toronto Maple Leafs yesterday by a score of 5-2. Todd Frazier, Matt Davidson, and Jose Abreu each hit solo homers in their game. Right-hander Mike Pelfrey picked up the victory after allowing just one run, four hits with no walks over six innings. Sox will finish their three-game series tomorrow in Toronto at 12:07 p.m. After three rounds at the U.S. Open, Brian Hartman is the leader at 12 under par. Justin Thomas, Brooks Koepka, and Tommy Fleetwood are all one shot back. A blockbuster trade is being finalized in the NBA. Multiple reports say the Celtics will trade their number one overall pick in next week's draft to Philadelphia. The Sixers are expected to select point guard Markelle Fultz. Josh Plyer, WGN Sports. Monday, happy day.
Dave and Josh Plyer, our resident pop culture historian Kevin Picorni, his son Ben, all of us back with you on this Father's Day weekend here on 720 WGN. So today's Father's Day, a good time to step back and ponder the evolution of the role of fathers on television from the very beginnings of the small screen, of course. Jim Anderson from Father Knows Best, Ward Cleaver, Leave It to Beaver, to Mike Brady of the Brady Bunch, Howard Cunningham of Happy Days, Cliff Huxtable of The Cosby Show, Ray Barone of Everybody Loves Raymond, Phil Dunphy of ABC's Modern Family. There's so many to choose from, and we want to hear your favorite. Who is your favorite TV dad? 312-981-7200. You can call. You can text throughout the whole show. I'm going to start with Kev. Kev, what do you? Where would you put your the top TV dad ever?
Number one.
Hold on, let me think.
I'm going to give you my number one.
Al Bundy.
That's a good guess.
He'd be the worst.
That's pretty good. Well, we can talk about that at some point, too.
Yeah.
I would say my favorite all time, and he's a single dad, Andy Griffith.
Oh, yeah.
You always think of dads that have to be surrounded by the family.
Yeah, with it. I like that.
Yeah, okay. That was a good one. How about Charles Ingalls? Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah.
I remember sitting watching that with my grandparents, and there was always a message there for you every time.
A lot of the list put that one and John Walton from The Waltons in the top five.
Oh, I didn't even think of John Walton.
In the top five there.
Certainly.
Yeah. Josh, what about you, buddy?
Well, you didn't mention Al Bundy, but I was thinking, because he's played two dads in TV. He's played in Married with Children, and he's played in Modern Family. I'd say he was probably better in Modern Family.
As a dad?
Oh, yeah.
Course, a little bit. Not by much, but a little bit.
I wouldn't say number one, though. But number one, I think you were right with Howard.
I was going to say you watch a lot of retro TV because I throw it in front of you, but you say Howard Cunningham, Tom Bosley.
Yeah, easily.
Happy Days. Ben?
I would say it's a more modern one. It's Tim Allen on Last Man Standing, a show just got canceled, unfortunately, but he played Mike Baxter. He's a man stuck in House of Women, three daughters and a wife, and owns a hunting company and is just the all-American dad, and you can't beat that. And then I would also say if I had a number two,
yeah,
I'd probably say Mike Brady from the Brady Bunch.
Okay, so you're going retro two on that. Mm-hmm. I like that.
I remember
that.
Watching the Brady Bunch with dad, yeah. Little. Nothing better than that.
Of course, yeah, absolutely. And how about you, Reg?
I got a couple of them.
Okay.
One will surprise you. Actually, I've got three. One will surprise you. So the first one is Fred McMurray.
Oh, My Three Sons.
My Three Sons.
Yeah. Another single dad we're talking about.
Another single dad. Just great. And I guess single dad's kind of the theme here because my other two choices.
My wife calls you and said we were getting divorced.
Hello. Darn.
What?
I shouldn't have said anything while I was taking
the news at the top of the
Yeah, right. That's my lead story. Got a good quote from her, too. No.
wow.
My second choice is Tom Corbett.
Tom Corbett.
People let me tell you about
You're talking about Courtship of Eddie's
father. That's right.
Mrs. Livingston.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Livingston, you remember.
Mr. Eddie's father.
Yeah. Camille, what about you?
Danny Tanner.
I knew you were going to say Full House. I knew you were going to say Full House. You're 90s.
It's nice to get a perspective from the kids.
All the kids in the studio. Exactly. All right. I've got a ton of texts. Homer Simpson. Kevin from Iowa says Homer Simpson. Fred Sanford, favorite TV dad. LOL, he writes out here at 630.
Big dummy.
I concur with Al Bundy, my favorite at times. Still makes me laugh till this day. There's another one that says Al Bundy was the worst, and absolutely, absolutely true there. Mine would be Howard Cunningham. I also love Phil Dunphy from Modern Family, but I've got some cool little clips here that Camille pulled of some of the best dads. Let's throw one out from Father Knows Best. Let's take a listen.
Hi, Dad.
Hello, Bud.
Say, can I talk to you alone? Just you and me?
Well, sure. Nothing wrong, is there?
No, but I just want to talk to you without Betty or Kathy butting in. Seems every time I try and say something, I get hit in the face with a petticoat.
Well, it's a tough life, son. But I'm with you.
Well, I was talking to Doug Harton today at school.
Hi, honey.
Well, hello, dear. How was your day?
Oh, the usual. Oh, Ruth Clark phoned. They're giving a dinner party tomorrow night. They'd like us to come.
Good, tell them we'll be there.
Mommy, the frosting's boiling.
Oh, dear, excuse me.
Oh, now, as you were saying?
Well, Doug Hartley, he's a guy at school, lives right down the block. He's got this car, and, Dad, you ought to see it. It's absolutely in perfect shape. It's got everything on it. Wheels, fenders, headlights, everything. Brakes were just relined. The radiator's just like new. Barely leaks at all. And the tires are in real good shape. They still got tread on them. It's a sensational car, Dad, and Doug wants to sell it. He'll let me have it for just $10.
$10?
Sure, and he's going to throw in a spare front axle and a complete set of road maps of northern Canada.
See, my mother loves Father Knows Best. I remember watching that on Channel 9, like every afternoon or whatever, you know.
Yeah, he was always everyone's best friend.
Yeah, he was a buddy.
Yeah, he had the answers for everything.
Yeah.
And if he didn't, he made you feel like he would eventually.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. This one from Leave It to Beaver, ridiculously sexist from, of course, today's standards. This is Camille shaking her head in there. Let's take a listen.
You know, Dad, it's funny.
What's funny?
Well, whenever we cook inside, Mom always does the cooking. But whenever we cook outside, you always do it. How come?
Well, it's sort of traditional, I guess. You know, they say a woman's place is in the home, and I suppose as long as she's in the home, she might as well be in the kitchen.
Oh. Well, that explains about Mom. But how come you always do the outside cooking?
Well, I'll tell you, son. Women do all right when they have all the modern conveniences. But us men are better at this rugged type of outdoor cooking. Sort of a throwback to caveman days. Hand me those asbestos gloves, would you, Molly?
Asbestos gloves? What the
heck?
Hand me those asbestos gloves.
Wow.
Yeah. And I've just seen Camille's head almost fell off when she shaking her head back and forth. That was fantastic.
But you knew if his wife had walked into the room,
that's true.
She would have given him a look.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. 708, Dad from Family Affair. He adopted Buffy and Jody.
Yeah.
So true. So true. Got some help from Mr. French, of course. 219, Davy Crockett. Always had a message.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. the old westerns. Actually, a lot of the riflemen and stuff talk about single dads.
Again, single dads. Isn't that weird? So many we didn't think of it. I'll give you one that is not really a dad, but he was a dad, and it's he passed away recently. Adam West. Batman. Bruce Wayne.
He was kind of a father.
He was the father to his ward.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's right.
I forgot about that, the way you put that. That's exactly right. That's right.
They both are.
They both are. 630 Archie Bunker and Meathead, both dads from All in the Family. It's from John. Let's hear a little Mike Brady, Camille.
Listen, I predict Marcia's going to pass her driver's test with flying colors.
Right, and I predict that Jan's going to do just great in today's debate.
And I predict that you two are great predictors.
Hi, Alice.
Hi.
Now, remember what I said about psyching yourself up, Jan?
Yeah, but I'm still nervous.
Oh, relax, Jan. Women can't be great at everything, but they make wonderful debaters.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Listen, do you mind if I offer you a suggestion?
Oh, I'll take any advice I can get, Dad.
There is a famous old story about a man who had to get up and speak in front of some very important people. He was petrified.
I'm with him.
Yeah, but a friend gave him some advice. He says, look, when you get up in front of those VIPs, you picture them sitting there in their underwear.
In their underwear?
Okay, do you remember that? That was, I think, when she was taking her driver's license, wasn't it?
Yeah.
No, I could go through every episode in my head easily on that one. My favorite Father's Day clip, I would say, out of all these that we're playing, Howard Cunningham, because he was my favorite. Richie came home drunk.
Oh.
Only because I think I related to it a little bit, because I must have been like 17. Now I'm telling my nephew and my son in front of me here. And had a little too many and came in the door.
We just had these drinks and these little teeny weeny glasses.
How many? It was like 72.
72. And I remember my dad, you know, I thought he would be ticked, and he never told my mom. And I know she's not listening, but I remember him sitting there in the bathroom with me, you know,
holding your hair for you.
Yeah, holding what hair I had.
When he
had it. Yeah, exactly.
It was a mullet.
Stop it.
Back
all right.
In the day.
Let's listen.
You're pretty sick, aren't you?
Well, it must have been something I ate. Probably a salami. You never know what they make salami out of, you know, Dad?
Yeah, that's true. Couldn't be that you had too much to drink now, could it?
Oh, that's silly. All we had was some beer and teeny weeny glasses.
How many teeny weeny glasses did you have?
72.
That's a favorite. That's a favorite. 312-981-7200. And I want to hear about this, and I've already gotten some text from you on this already. The Cosby Show. It was a phenomenal show. Cliff Huxtable, great example as a dad in the series. How do you separate Bill Cosby, what's going on, you know, mistrial. So this whole court thing is going to start all over again soon. So how do you separate the two to say, wow, this was a great show? Because 5 years ago, if the rankings came out, Cosby Show probably would have been number one. Mm-hmm. And now when I see the lists, it's nowhere to be found. Because now from a politically correct perspective, it's gone. 312-981-7200. We'll talk about that next on 720 WGN. All right, we're talking best TV dads of all time, 312-981-7200. And we just brought up a little bit about The Cosby Show. That, you know, this week, obviously, actually today, his court trial was noted as a mistrial, and so they're going to go back to court on this whole thing. So 5 years ago, 4 years ago, you would have seen The Cosby Show at the top of the list, Roger, on this whole thing, and I know you've been following this news story as it's been happening.
Yeah.
You know, where do you rank it? How do you separate? You got to think about all these kids, and Felicia Rashad and all the people that executive produced this show. Outstanding show.
Mm-hmm.
How do you separate the two?
It's very difficult for people, obviously. You don't have The Cosby Show without Bill Cosby.
Right.
So if you separate the actor out from the show, how do you rate the show? You can't.
Yeah.
So if you're ranking that show as, according to your list there, of all-time great TV dads... Yeah. Then you have to consider the show because it ruled. It ruled for a long time TV. It ruled. Yeah. It knocked out all the competition on, I believe it was Thursday nights.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, it was number one.
Number one by huge numbers.
But now when you watch it, and I was watching it, as I said yesterday, mm-hmm. I watched a little bit of it. You know, looking at him, I know because of the court documents that were released about his deposition that he took years ago mm-hmm. for this woman. He said, he admitted that he gave people sedatives and so forth. So you know it. You don't know about this specific relationship, but it's really tough to watch. Kev, what about you?
I do think this is the world that we live in right now, that people can't do that. And they won't let that happen. And I'm actually kind of surprised that if you were to jump on the air right now and say number one dad of all time, Cliff Huxtable.
Yeah,
it's Bill Cosby. This board's gonna light up like a Christmas tree. And people are gonna call in and tell you no, because of what he's done, you can no longer consider that.
Yeah, Leo, you're on 720 WGN. You have a favorite TV dad?
Well, I can't really pick a favorite. There's lots of good ones, I'm sure. But in that book, Growing Up Brady, Barry Williams, who played Greg mm-hmm. on the Brady Bunch,
yep.
he mentioned something that I guess we could thank Mike Brady, or we could thank Robert Reed for however good Mike Brady is as a dad. He mentions that Robert Reed and Sherwood Schwartz had a long going feud about how Mike Brady would be a dad. Sherwood Schwartz apparently wanted him to be a kind of jokey sort of person, if I understand right from what Barry Williams wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Reed insisted that there can be, there can be humor, whatever, but all times Mike has to be a father and Florence has to be a mother. It was kind of like Mike Brady. I keep getting the character name confused with the
actor.
That's
okay. I don't know.
So Robert Reed basically insisted that he's got to be a dad. The show has to be grounded in reality. You know, it can be funny. It can be watchable. But it's got to be a real dad and a real mom in a real family, basically.
Well, because he shows actually set an example. So, yeah, he did fight that. He did fight the silliness sometimes of the show, and he needed to be a disciplinarian. He needed to be a dad. I agree with you 1,000%. Leo, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it, pal. I also got another text here, 815. Good evening. Happy Father's Day. My first nominee is George Jetson. Judy Elroy and Astro adored him. He was far out. My second, you got to think about Fred Flintstone then as well.
Yes, just to say.
My second nomination is Dr. Jason Seaver from Growing Pains. He was a cool dad, and his wife was pretty nice looking. that's a good point.
And I know a personal favorite, me and my dad, watching on demand, Xfinity, just old shows, a cartoon called King of the Hill.
Okay.
Yeah. Hank Hill.
It's a Mike Judge show.
Classic cartoon, just a great
clean
all-around
cut,
show.
Conservative guy. And
propane.
Propane and propane accessories.
And you mentioned you had one too, an animated one.
Well, no, animated, but I was gonna add Tony Soprano in there.
You know what? You know what's funny? There's a lot of people I've brought that up before that think he's
with this criminal background, like.
But as a father,
as a father figure, he brings in the money. He's trying to be there for his
kids.
Of course,
that's interesting.
We justifying this now.
But Family Guy, you're talking about Family Guy.
I was going to say Al Bundy.
Horrible.
No, Family Guy.
No, oh, Family Guy.
Peter Griffin.
Peter Griffin.
Yeah. Yeah.
If farting on your kid's face and pushing him down a staircase is good parenting, then
He's number one.
Tempting to forget about
Roger,
your daughter.
Did you do that to your kids?
Never.
Okay, all right, fair enough.
At least not that they know.
Let's see here, 502. What area code is 502? Herman Munster and grandpa. Yeah, exactly.
I would affiliate Herman Munster with Peter Griffin kind of on the...
708, I used to like The Courtship of Eddie's Father with Bill Bixby. There's another mm-hmm. one in there. I've got a couple clips I want to play. We're going to go a little long on
502
this.
502 area code, Louisville, Kentucky.
Is that what it is? Louisville? Yeah. See, everybody's listening. Rob Petrie, the Dick Van Dyke Show, is another one.
Yes.
Ozzie Nelson, we mentioned. Archie Bunker, of course. Let me see here. Ben Cartwright on Bonanza was another one. Mm-hmm. Martin Lane on the Patty Duke Show. George Jefferson. Rocky Rockford on the Rockford Files. Martin Crane on Frasier. I like that. George Jefferson himself. Darren Stevens was a dad. He was always angry.
Oh, George Bluth.
And drinking. George Bluth from Arrested Development.
Yeah.
I would say he would be one of the worst dads in history. Let's take a listen to some clips of some more of the contemporary ones. Let's listen to Phil Dunphy from Modern Family.
I'm the cool dad. That's my thing. I'm hip. I surf the web. I text. LOL. Laugh out loud. OMG. Oh my God. WTF. Why the face? I know all the dances to High School Musical. So.
Well, yes, he was a cool dad. I'm going to play a little bit of the wisdom of the Cosby Show. Let's take a listen.
Oh, come to think of it, you never wear any of your Father's Day gifts.
The reason why I don't wear them, dear, is because when you go to get me presents, you go to get me things that you want to see me in. You don't get me things that I like.
Because that's not true.
Yes, it is true. You see, Father's Day has been like that for a long, long time. There are fathers all over the world who get presents that they can't use and don't want. No, I'm serious. From day one, when Eve and the boys gave Adam the first soap on the roof.
Oh, Cliff.
I'm not kidding. Listen, I'm going to tell you, I have a closet here that is full of presents that they sell only on one holiday. Father's Day!
It's so true. So true. All right, I'm going to throw one more out there. This is when Archie first met his son-in-law, Meathead. Let's take a listen.
Boy. Let me tell you something, Mr. Punker.
No, let me tell you something, Mr. Stivic. You are a meathead.
What did you call me?
I am meathead, dead from the neck up.
Now I see what your idea of a free country is. You're free to say anything you want, but if anyone disagrees with you, they're either thrown into jail or called a meathead, right?
That's right, because this is America, the land that I love.
Oh, I love it too, Mr. Bunker, and it's because I do. I protest when I think things are wrong.
And stand beside her. And guide her.
With
the light from above.
Listen to me. It's in the Bill of Rights.
From the mountains.
Why do you think we broke away from England to begin with, huh? Because we didn't agree with her. We demanded freedom.
Why would we fall?
So there's a great dad right there. Here's another one. 219 Cartoon Dad Clutch Cargo. He was kind of a dad to spin it.
Uncle Dave, you, when I was really young, gifted me a box set of Clutch Cargo. Three DVDs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Returning with the Pharaoh's Man or some random title. Just the classic. The monotone voice intro into Clutch Cargo, Spinner and Paddlefoot, the Headhunters. Yeah, you have the.
You're a better man for it.
Oh gosh, yeah, I could remember sick days when I was little watching Clutch Cargo.
See, I love that. That's because that's a generation that would have never seen that.
How about Johnny Storm?
Johnny Storm.
Was it Johnny Quest? Johnny Quest. Oh, yes. Johnny Quest.
I got another one, 219 Chuck Connors from The Rifleman. Okay. Another Al Bundy. I got a lot of Al Bundys here. Let's see here. Uncle Phil from The Fresh Prince was a good dad.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see.
Took him into that home. Else?
He did. He absolutely
did. Anybody say Walter White yet? Or?
Yes, someone said Walter White. Yeah, exactly. The worst TV dads, just a quick list, then we're going to have to go to break here. Randy Marsh from South Park, Frank Costanza from Seinfeld, Tony Soprano's on the worst list, a lot of them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, certainly.
Don Draper from Mad Men, if you watched Mad Men, terrible, terrible. And Homer Simpson makes the worst list, as well as George Bluth. So they all make the worst list.
Perfect.
So those are your best and worst Father's Day dads. We're going to be talking retro beers. The beers maybe you grew up with, some of the ones that are regional, some not. We'll talk about that next. 720 WGN.
And with WGN Sports, Ben Pokorny.
Thanks, Roger. The White Sox started out their weekend series against the Blue Jays with a 5-2 win in Toronto. Mike Pelfrey went 6 innings on the mound and struck out 5. Todd Frazier went deep in the second inning to chalk up his 11th home run of the season. The Northsiders faced off with their division rival Pittsburgh Pirates. Jake Arrieta was starting on the mound for the Cubs. He also helped out on the offensive side when he crushed a two-run homer in the second inning, his first of the year. That was not enough for the Cubbies. They fell 4-3. To golf in the U.S. Open at Erin Hills, Brian Harman is in the lead at 12 strokes under par heading into the final round to play. Justin Thomas and others trail just behind him at 11 under. And Bears news star running back Jordan Howard recently underwent laser eye surgery to upgrade his vision to 20/20. Howard will be ready for training camp in just a few weeks' time and will be potentially looking to make his second Pro Bowl appearance. Ben Picorni, WGN Sports.
Day player on 720 WGN. So retro beers are cool again. Who needs the latest craft beer when throwback beers like PBR, Ham, Stroh's, Old Style, Schlitz are bigger than ever in Chicago and across America? What is your favorite retro beer, the beer you drank in college? Which throwback beer have you discovered again? Do you want to know if a classic beer is still being made? We've got a lot of information here. 312-981-7200. You can call or text anytime. And joining me to break that all down is pop culture historian Kevin Picorni. Our two underage drinkers are here. They will not be talking too much about this.
What, no samples?
They can ask questions. They can ask questions. Are you opening up a PBR?
Hold on.
Ooh, very nice.
Look at that.
Get a full effect here, boys and girls.
With the boys.
Camille's saying, I need one of those right now. So, Time Magazine had recently talked about the resurgence of this cheap, old-school, mass-market beer. And, you know, we were talking about the fact that beer that our grandparents and maybe even our dads drank kind of skipped a generation. I mean, you know, when I was in college, it was Schaefer's, it was Stroh's, it was Busch, it was whatever, it was crap beer, red, white, and blue, and all
old
that.
Old Milwaukee.
But what I'm saying is those beers though have, especially PBR and Old Style, especially Old Style,
boom,
big resurgence in the college crowds.
No, you and I were you were stopped by my house last week, took a peek in my fridge. Yeah. What's in there?
Yeah.
I do have some of the, just some IPAs, craft beers and whatnot, but Old Style and PBR.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I live in on a street where we have some 30-somethings, a good number of them, and a lot of guys wind up over at my house, you know, watch the Cubs game outside on the back porch, and it's fun stuff. They know the refrigerator's out there in the garage, and the 35-year-olds are coming back from the garage with PBR.
So none of your craft stuff is leaving the house.
It's not being touched.
Yeah. Okay.
Now that's something.
Now I'm going to ask Camille, okay, because you're a new drinker.
Yeah. 22. So, yeah. 22.
Welcome.
One year under
my belt. Welcome. Happy to have you.
So you had your first beer a year ago.
Yeah.
And what do you drink? What is your age group drinking right now?
See, my personal favorite, it's Blue Moon, so not retro. But if I do...
Which is a top 10.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know a lot of people back at Ball State were buying Old Style PBR. Those were the top two. And Miller Lite.
Yeah. See, in Old Style, I will tell you something. Now, I will have my craft beer. I love my Goose Islands and my Bourbon County Stouts and all that other stuff, as you know. But when I go to Wrigley, I will drink nothing but Old Style.
Right.
And I know exactly. By the way, there's more accessibility to Old Style now.
Right.
At Wrigley.
And you have to, they're not vending it to you at your seats.
No, that's the only
but
thing.
But it's there.
But there's more places, you know, on draft that you can get it. Roger, now what about you? I know you're probably thinking about a beer right now, but what,
Oh, yes, I am.
What would you, what were some of the retro classic beers of your day?
Well, if we go back to my early days at Wrigley Field, and Dad would let me sip the foam off the beer, there was only one beer at Wrigley.
Well, which one was that?
Hams.
It was Hams.
Yeah.
Right. Because you know what? I've got coasters
mm-hmm.
that say Hams, Cubs, and have WGN Channel That's 9 right. on there.
If I'm not mistaken, one of the commercials that they would show in between the innings of the Cubs game, the Hams commercial was of the Bear hitting a home run, and he had this Cubs hat that
That's
he
right.
he'd flip
That's
up
right.
in the air.
No, I yeah. think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I grew up on it. Now, I while in college, I imbibed quite a bit in alcoholic beverages. But as we started raising the family and didn't have time for much and everything, I kind of got away from beer. alcohol totally until about a couple of years ago when I was bowling actually one night and the bowling alley had hams.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't find that much. You don't find hams. You find...
Is that what where I met you?
Yeah, at that bowling alley.
Yeah, yeah. Really?
Well, I mean, okay.
Hams hung out there for about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But they only serve it in cans, though. They don't have
a
bottle.
Right, right. It's not on tap, not in bottles.
Yeah.
It's in cans.
Yeah.
And I tried one, and I go, you know, I just, the whole body flew back. Mm-hmm. To my young days at Wrigley Field. It was that taste, and then there was a restaurant that we go to not far from us that also advertises and serves hams, and so I would have one there whenever we'd go there. And so I have had a few in the last couple of years, and they taste wonderful. I get looks from my bowling teammates whenever I bring the hams over. Of good Lord, why are you drinking that?
I like that.
Because they're sitting there with their summer shady and
I get that with Old Style, too. They're like, really? You're drinking Old Style? That's like,
Not anymore.
And there's a difference, by the way, when I was having a beer. Where was I? Oh, with my dad. Mm-hmm. My dad, speaking of Father's Day, retired from working for the Village.
Congratulations to him.
50 years, man.
Isn't that something?
50 years. But we went out and had a beer afterwards, and my dad got a craft beer. So his beer actually has some color to it, and my Old Style. I could read a book through my glass of Old Style. Old Style's my beer. But hams, I'm trying to look at hams here. Theater Ham Brewing Company was established 1865. His son William and grandson William Jr. inherited the operation in 1903. During Prohibition, the company survived by producing soft drinks and other products. In 1968, it was acquired by a company that sold it to Olympia Brewing, and then Pabst purchased Olympia along with hams in 1983, and then Miller acquired the brand in 1999. So Miller actually makes
hams. Aren't
you
finding a lot of this as you're looking back at these beers with the rebranding? Every paragraph ends with now owned by Pabst Miller.
Oh yeah. Well, you know what? It was Metropolis Brewing Company that originally bought Pabst, and it was two young brothers in their 20s that bought it, and then they started looking at the value of all these local beers that are Old Style and Old Milwaukee and Schlitz and all that other good stuff. So very cool stuff. Robert, you're on 720 WGN. You have a favorite that's one of those locally produced beers.
Yeah, I love Point Beer.
And where do you get Point?
Stevens Point, Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Yeah. There you go. Don't they still make... Go ahead.
I said that to the lady who answered the phone, and she went, what? Point what?
But Point, too, don't they make sodas, too?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
And they make root beer.
Yeah. I like the Point root beer.
How can you beat $7 for a case of beer?
No, you can't.
Okay, you just can't. Hey, real quick though, what's really good because I'm older and I drinking and whatnot. This new Miller 64 is very good.
Is it really? I have not tried it. Okay.
If you try it, try it next to a Miller Light and a 64, both in bottles, both nice and cold. Can't tell the difference. And you can drink three or four 64s and get up and run around the block, which you can't do with a lot of beers.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
Great show, guys. Happy Father's Day.
Thanks, Robert. Same to you, buddy. Hey, Patrick, you're on 720 WGN. You got a local favorite. That's one of mine, too.
Okay. I was a kid at 16 years old, and my place of business sold a beer called Blatz.
Oh, yeah.
Easy. And they actually, I'm pretty sure I went last year through Wisconsin, downtown Milwaukee, and I swear they have a sign up for Blatz.
Oh, yeah. In fact, there's some places that still are still serving it on tap. I mean, that's not unusual by any means. Oh, yeah. Blatz is a.
Oh, really?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Blatz is as classic as Schlitz, I think.
I work in a lot of, I do refrigeration. I have not seen it in my lifetime since when I worked 25 years ago as a waiter. Anywho, how about Coors?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if Nope. You guys remember?
Oh, yeah, well, I do. And they still sell that, but... Yeah.
And I remember this is classic. It just, you know, boyhood memories.
Oh, yeah, and those little banquet bottles are selling again.
Airplane coming back from Hawaii. Cool. And this beautiful, maybe lady 20 years old, maybe 10 years older than me, but just gorgeous lady. And she asked for a Coors on the airplane, and the lady said, no, we can't serve it because we're past a certain point in the airplane.
Oh, wow.
She's like, you know, if you would have asked me, honey, 10 minutes earlier, I could have served it to you. But we're past a certain point. I can't serve it. I'm like, I was like 15, 16 years old, and this chick was like, you know, again, everybody's dream. And I'm like, wait. And then she made a big deal about it.
Yeah.
She's like, wait a minute. I can't get my course now because we're past a certain point. You have it on a plane, but I can't have it because we passed it. She said, oh, no, sorry, honey. No, we can't serve it to you. I'm sorry.
I think the Coors was also the focus of Smokey and the Bandit, which is 40 years old. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the beer that they were?
Yeah, it was. You are correct.
Thanks, Patrick, for the call. Appreciate it, buddy.
Thank you.
You talked about, we just heard about Point Beer, and we heard about Coors. Two things. Point Beer, the third oldest privately owned brewery in the country.
Really?
Yeah. We're talking about all these.
We buy the soda. I've never bought the beer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Coors, when they went through a downtime, they were producing malted milk and selling it to the Mars Company.
They had to stay alive.
Yeah.
They had to stay alive. All right. More talk about beer and retro beer. 312-981-7200. We'll talk more next. 720 WGN.
From the land of sky blue waters.
Waters.
From the land of pines, lofty blossoms. Pour an ice-cold hams and treat yourself to the premium beer from the land of sky-blue waters. Great-tasting hams. Hams, beer refreshing. Hams, beer refreshing.
All right, it's Dave Player on 720 WGM. Looking at some of the texts here that have been coming in, I want to make sure I get to those, too, before we... before we get this escape from Stroh's ruled in 72. That's 219. 219, my dad drank Drury's beer in the 60s. I worked with the guys that drank Blatz and Schlitz, which is close to what I gave you. Always love the Hams beer commercials. Love the jingle, of course. Remember the commercial? I'm from Milwaukee and I ought to know the Blatz beer tastes great wherever you go. 219, wow. Another one, Carling Black Label Beer, the champagne of bottled beer.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I'm looking at some of the other ones. We talked about Schlitz a little bit. PBR, of course, is the big one. Schaefer's, Stroh's, Rainier, which is also owned by Pabst. Stag, Pearl, Schmitz Beer, Lone Star, and Meisterbrau. What do you got on Meisterbrau?
Meisterbrau. That was my grandfather's favorite. I remember running down to the fridge in my grandfather's basement. Algonquin,
okay.
Grandpa Picorni, to grab the Meisterbrau.
Yeah.
Later on, Meisterbrau starts to brew what they call, and we call them light beers today, they called it a diet beer.
Really?
Meisterbrau came out with a diet beer, but it was too late. Meisterbrau was already going under, but they sold this recipe.
Wow.
For this diet beer, it was purchased by Miller Company. Today, when you're drinking Miller Lite, you're drinking Diet Meisterbrau.
Gross. That sounds disgusting. That sounds disgusting.
And you know, Meisterbrau has a connection to WGN Radio.
Tell me.
Back in the 60s, Franklin McCormick, who used to have the overnight show here, it was the Meisterbrau Showcase.
Oh, that's cool.
It was sponsored by Meisterbrau.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Marty, you're on 720 WGN. You got a fave?
Yeah, hi. This is Marty. I basically used to be in the early 80s with a driver for an old-style distributor. At the end of the day, when the guys came in and went to the local gin mill, or you know, we always would drink Special Export Light, which was an old-style product.
It was a Heidemann's, yeah.
Yeah, we don't so much we drank the export. That was a little too heavy, but the export light was good. As far as my favorite today, and I'm glad to hear it's coming to Indiana, is Yingling.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Oh, I got Camille is raising her hands in there. Mm-hmm. All right, you love that too. The special export, was that like a darker beer? What was that?
You know, they had three types. They had the darker, they had the regular, and then basically a light beer. And the light beer, for some reason, had a nice, you know, it was good, but it was smooth. And I don't know why. The drivers would always tap into that. That was what we preferred. It wasn't the other stuff. It was the light stuff.
Very cool. Marty, thanks for the call, buddy. Grain Belt is another one. And I discovered that when I lived in Minnesota. No, yeah, it's very old-style.
Yeah, you like this one. I know.
It's very old-style-ish for Minneapolis. Lowenbrau. Let it be Lowenbrau. I'm going to just list you the top 10 beers that sell in the U.S., like biggest sales from the top. Number one is Bud Light. Two is Coors Light.
Really?
Three is Miller Light. Yep. Four is Budweiser. Five, Michelob Ultra Light. Six, Natty Light.
Oy.
Seven, Busch Light. Seriously, this is the best-selling beers in America. Camille, you're a big Busch Light, Natty Light, which I know.
It's just like, nothing.
Miller Light. Miller High Life, excuse me. Number nine is Busch, and 10 is Keystone Light. Those are the best-selling beers.
You're naming a lot of the low-calorie beers.
Yeah.
That are on the market. Every one of those that you just mentioned, is, except for one, is under 100 calories.
I'm going to have Camille play one commercial that is so inappropriate but is so classic. It's a Busch beer commercial featuring the Flintstones. Let's take a listen.
When you do for a beer, Busch does it. You can't say beer better than Busch.
Boy, ain't that the truth. How can they miss with that target advertising? Yabba-dabba-doo!
Right on target, Fred.
When you do for a beer, Busch does it.
We played a Winston cigarettes commercial for the Flintstones.
Yeah.
And what cracks me up is, I mean, you got to remember, guys, and I'm going to talk to the two young guys here, too. They were the Simpsons. They were actually, it was a very highbrow sitcom that aired in prime time. So the Flintstones was not, it was a kid's show for us
right.
when we watched
right.
the reruns.
It was targeted.
But it was targeted for that, exactly. Yeah. All right, do we have time for one more beer commercial? I'm going to play one more. Let's do the old style commercial.
God
Let's
bless
take a
you,
little
sir.
Listen.
This is God's country, the place Gottlieb Heilemann chose to brew old style. Heilemann's old style is brewed with sparkling, pure Wisconsin spring water, virgin water that flows from deep beneath the ground. Brewed in world way called Kreuzling, the most natural way to brew beer and the most expensive. Try old style, pure brewed in God's country, and taste the difference Kreuzling makes.
Now there it is, a little old style.
I closed my eyes and I was in the middle of a Cubs game on TV. Bill Buckner was at first. Mike Kruko was pitching.
Listen to you. I love that. Those are some of the best. Schmidt Beer was well known in Minnesota, coincidentally the land of sky blue waters, because they used to have a variety of pictures on their cans.
Yes.
I used to know a person that had a collection of some of them.
Yeah.
Olympia Gold is another one. And Pop Tops. People are talking about the disappearance of Pop Tops.
Of course, yeah.
There's a place in Wisconsin called Mars Resort on Lake Como, and they have pictures, I think it's of... Josh, is it of hams? What is it exactly?
No, it's the hams. The frames are old hams advertisement that they made
from the 60s.
Yeah, and they just have like
That's
lighted
cool. They're still vibrant.
Lake pictures
kind of big up there. I love that. Okay, all right, so we're going to... we're going to go right to the news.
WGN Sports, here's Josh Pyer.
Thanks, Roger. The Cubs fell in Pittsburgh 4-3. Jake Arrieta took the loss despite striking out 7 Pirates. Arrieta also cranked a 2-run bomb at the plate. Addison Russell hit his 6th homer. Cubs will finish their 3-game series tomorrow in Philadelphia at 12:35 p.m. The White Sox won their second series game against the Toronto Blue Jays yesterday by a score of 5-2. Todd Frazier, Matt Davidson, and Jose Abreu each solo hit home runs in that game. Right-hander Mike Pelfrey picked up the victory after allowing just 1 run on 4 hits with no walks over 6 innings. Sox will finish their 3-game series tomorrow in Toronto at 12:07 p.m. After 3 rounds at the U.S. Open, Brian Hartman is the leader at 12 under par. Justin Thomas, Brooks Koepka, and Tommy Fleetwood are all one shot back. A blockbuster trade is being finalized in the NBA. Multiple reports say the Celtics will trade the number one overall pick in next week's draft to Philadelphia. The Sixers are expected to select point guard Markelle Fultz. Josh Plyer, WGN Sports.
State player on 720 WGN. So few groups in rock and roll history can match the achievements of legendary rock and rollers, the Beach Boys. They've sold over 100 million records and charted over 80 songs worldwide, 36 of them top 40 hits in the U.S., the most by an American rock and roll band in history. The Beach Boys will be playing at Ravinia on Sunday, July 2nd, which if you've never seen them live, now's your chance to get your tickets right now at ravinia.org. And joining us to share his story and the band's legacy is music icon Mike Love. Mike, welcome back and happy summer to you.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me on the program.
Absolutely. Oh, man, I'm thrilled to be talking to you. I am a huge, huge fan. And what always intrigues me about you guys is there is a love for the Beach Boys music that has been unmatched and has crossed 3 to 4 generations.
Well, 172 shows last year.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. This year, probably around 150, and we're as you said, celebrating 50 years of Good Vibrations. I wrote that song with my cousin Brian 50 years ago.
Wow.
And in fact, it came out in the fall of 1966, and it went to number one, and we were voted the number one group in England, or Great Britain anyway, and number two being the Beatles, and 4 was the Rolling Stones. So
amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was an amazing year.
You know, when we're at barbecues at my folks, my dad's playing the Beach Boys in the summer in the backyard. I listen to it. I play it in the car. My 10-year-old knows all your songs. That's what I'm saying. It just crosses so many generations. People love your music.
I have a 20-year-old daughter, Dave, that would, before she could speak, she would toddle up to the record player and go, bah, bah, bah. She wanted to hear Barbara Ann.
That's awesome.
Also came out 50 years ago. Barbara Ann became a huge hit record for
wow.
us, along with the Pet Sounds album, which came out in 66. So this year is a golden anniversary of a lot of great stuff from the Beach Boys.
Absolutely. What are the early origins of the Beach Boys? You and the Wilson Boys were cousins, and you hung out a lot as kids, and you sang together.
A tremendous amount. Actually, every holiday, Thanksgiving, Christmas, Easter, any birthday or anything, it always music was the central focus of any celebration that we would have as a family. And when my mother came to California along with her siblings, they were so poor. They came from Dust Bowl conditions in Kansas. My father's side came from rural Louisiana, at least my grandfather Love did. And these people, they didn't have any money, but they had music, especially the Wilson side of the family. My mom sang on the radio in the 1930s.
Wow.
It was a big deal. So music wasn't because we never went into music thinking we'd become famous or you know, make any money at it. We just love creating those harmonies together, and those harmonies are what distinguishes the Beach Boys from so many other groups. And it's because of the love of the music, nothing else.
Well, you did this for family fun. It was really family mm-hmm. get-together. So where did the idea come about that, hey, let's actually formalize this, let's create a band? How did that come about?
Well, my cousin Dennis and I would go fishing off the Redondo Beach breakwater, and we would talk, and we started talking about surfing, which I'd go with my high school friends. If the surf is up, we'd miss a few afternoon classes, to be honest. And we'd drive down to the beach and have a great time. And so surfing preceded the Beach Boys. You know, it was our high school experience growing up in Southern California. And that gave rise, that whole environment, you know, just living a few miles away from the beach, gave rise to the idea of doing a song about surfing, because there's this whole cult around surfing, the way you dress, the way you, some of the words you would use, and just your attitude in life and stuff. It was all like a little mini subculture mm-hmm. there in Southern California. So we decided to make up a song about it, and that was our first record called Surfing. Our second one was Surfing Safari. Third one was Surfing USA. So each year,
yeah.
1961, 2, and 3, each year the whole phenomenon grew, and very quickly in the early to mid-60s, the Beach Boys became world-renowned.
Well, and you were the Pendletones at first, and I have to, because you kind of, you created this music, so, you know, who were your influences? Because, you know, usually, you know, rockers will go back to blues and jazz, so forth, but you created this style of music, so who did you look up to?
Well, primarily, I think Chuck Berry, for me, was the biggest influence in terms of songwriting. But the Everly Brothers are a huge influence because of their beautiful blend.
Sure, right.
And the Four Freshmen were an amazing group of singers and performers back in the 50s. They influenced us because of their very sophisticated, close four-part harmonies. And so if you put those influences all together, along with doo-wop, you know, with the high parts and the low parts and the neat stories, those were the major influences, I would say, other than growing up and doing, you know, church youth nights and sure. sing-alongs and stuff like that. So those were the major influences, Chuck Berry, the Everly Brothers, the Four Freshmen, and doo-wop itself.
So you create the song Surfin', and Candix Records, which was an independent label, released the song, but now under the Beach Boys. So how did you go from the Pendletones to the Beach Boys?
A fellow named Russ Regan, who was a record promotion man at the time and eventually became the head of a couple of big major record companies, he actually is the one who named us that. Pendleton Mills made these kind of woolen shirts that were plaid that you would wear over your T-shirt when you're at the beach to keep warm. So the surfers all wore the Pendleton shirts, Pendleton Mills. Mm-hmm. So we called ourselves the Pendletones, you know, but that didn't stick because when we heard Surfin' by the Beach Boys, we said, well, that's better than what we got. so we eagerly adopted the term the Beach Boys, and it made sense because, you know, we're all from that Southern California environment. Dennis Wilson and I and Al Jardine, we all had our surfboards and you know, were we good surfers? That's debatable.
Okay.
But we were part of that culture, you know, part of that Southern California culture, and it became the very cornerstone of our success.
In the very beginning, how did you all decide who was going to do what exactly with the band?
I would sit down and write music with my cousin Brian. So he would sit at the piano. I would stand beside him with a notebook or some paper, and we would figure out the songs. He would come up with the chord progressions primarily. I would come up with the lyrics and the concepts. So because I was sitting there right with him writing the songs, it fell to me a lot of songs to sing the lead. So whether it be Surfin' Safari or Surfin' USA or California Girls or I Get Around or Fun, 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 any of those songs, I would sing the lead because we were writing them together. Mm-hmm. So he would be banging them out. I'd be singing along, and I'd be coming up with the words or the hooks, like Round, Round, Get Around, I Get Around. I came up with that. So because he and I wrote them together, it fell to me to sing the lead on many of them. Of course, on the ballads, he would take the high part,
sure.
I would take the low part, and Carl and Alan would be in between on something like In My Room or Surfer Girl or that kind of thing.
You released the second single, Surfin' Safari, back with 409, and soon thereafter you signed with Capitol Records, and Surfin' USA came out. Was that the song, Surfin' USA, that really got you national attention? Was that the big one?
Yeah, it was. It showed up in the charts in Israel, South Africa, Australia, Philippines, you know, all over Scandinavia. But it turns out Surfin' is very close to Surpin', which means drinking. So it was a drinking safari or drinking USA.
People love that, I'm sure.
to some people, yeah. I mean, it worked.
That's awesome. Now, I know the Beatles were on the Sullivan Show in 64, also on Capitol Records. It doesn't seem like they really made a big impact at all on what you guys were doing here because the hits just kept coming.
Well, it was an impact because they were so tremendously popular, and it was like an explosion of popularity. But right, like I was saying earlier, that, you know, in 1966, we had Good Vibrations. We were voted the number one group in Great Britain. So even at the height of Beatlemania and stuff, the Beach Boys did, I mean, you know, we were awed by their success and their creativity as they were ours. You know, I mean, the Pet Sounds album really blew a couple of minds. And, you know, John Lennon and Paul McCartney, they listened to it and Paul said, oh my, what are we, dear me, what are we going to do?
That's awesome.
So they got busy with Sgt. Pepper's. And in Rolling Stone magazine, they had a coffee table of the top 500 albums of all times or something. And number one is Sgt. Pepper's, and number two is Pet Sounds.
Yeah, exactly.
So I demand a recount.
Nice. Well, then, you know, I Get Around came up. Fun was the other one. And I know I've heard you quoted as saying this, that you might have sang Fun now for like the 6,000th time.
Probably close to it. I mean, we've done at least 5,500 shows over the last 55 years. So it's very likely that we have done it, because that was, you know, one of the earlier big singles. And we close our show with it. And I like to leave the people leaving them think the concerts thinking fun. They had fun
when they came to see it. So, absolutely.
To me, that's pretty important. That's the whole idea about our show, is to create some positivity. And sure, we have some melancholy stuff, like if we'll sing The Warmth of the Sun or In My Room, but you know, there's some upbeat, real fun songs, you know, Help Me Rhonda, I Get Around, fun, Surfing USA, all those.
Oh, they're all upbeat. You can't help but feel good when you listen to the music.
And that's the idea, because I've always called what we do a sonic oasis. There's a lot of problems in the world, a lot of problems in personal lives, and you know, and for a period of time to either play a song, play an album, or come to a concert, you know, we don't avoid emotion, that's for sure, because we've all experienced it, and we put it into our songs, God Only Knows, and, you know, that kind of thing. But I think the music should be to uplift and entertain and bring happiness. That's my, you know, I like to accentuate the positive. Even if something isn't fantastic, you can usually find something good about whether it was, you know, falling out of love with somebody or somebody didn't love you anymore. At least you had felt that feeling at one time. So there's a whole range of emotions that Beach Boys music touches upon. And I think we've gotten nothing but great positive feedback over the years from so many, you know, thousands of people.
Absolutely. And people do sing along to your songs. Does that bother you when they sing along, or does that kind of embrace you a little bit, that everyone just wants to be a part of the experience?
Well, not at all. I mean, there's some songs that are more sing along than others, like Help Me Run is
big.
Kokomo, Aruba, Jamaica, Wanna Take
from It. From Cocktail.
Bahama, come
over. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's a huge sing-along. Ooh, I Wanna Take It Down to Kokomo. You know, I mean, it's fun. Those songs are really fun and Help Me Rhonda come up. Surfing USA, Inside, Outside USA. Everybody's singing along. It's a party. It's really fun. Now, there's other songs, like we're doing In My Room, people just sit and they listen. Or if we're doing The Warmth of the Sun.
Or Sway.
Listen.
You know, it just is being part of that experience. And you did so many live albums, too. You did the first live album ever to hit number one. In 1970, you guys signed a contract with Reprise, released a double album, The Beach Boys in Concert, that went gold. Your live albums were huge.
Well, you know what it is? The Beach Boys live, I mean, that's where it's at. I mean, records are great and radio's great and having your songs and soundtracks is wonderful. And it's all good. But the experience of a live concert where the music is being performed by the group that was involved in making it, and the energy between the audience and the performers is amazing. I find that, you know, multiple generations, I mean, grandfathers, grandmothers, and their children, their children's children, they'll all come out to a show and they'll all enjoy the same music together as a family.
Over the years, there's been infighting, of course, with the band, and when you're part of a group, that does happen, and the stress of traveling and recording records and all this other stuff. And I know the answer to this already, but you've kept yourself pretty grounded for almost 50 years, and that's due to meditation. How did that all kind of come about?
In December of 1967, we were invited to go to Paris to do a UNICEF show. It was a fundraiser to help, you know, raise money for UNICEF for children through the UN. And there was a big gala in Paris. And during the rehearsals for that gala, we met Maharishi. And he then subsequently, we got invited to learn TM, or Transcendental Meditation, from Maharishi, December of 67 in Paris. 2 months later, I found myself in India because at his invitation, none of the other guys went there, but Alan Jardine and I continued to meditate, whereas the Wilson brothers veered off into other lifestyle choices. Right. But Alan and I actually attended a TM teacher training course in like 1972, I believe it was. And so, yeah, I've been meditating ever since December of 67, gone to India, went to a six-month-long meditation course. You know, that there's a lot of ups and downs in any kind of business,
right,
any kind of life, any kind of relationship situation. But what I've found is meditation has helped you cope with the stress of it and not let it grip you and destroy you, which is a really powerful tool. But it also gives you clarity and energy, because you lower your metabolism to a level of rest twice as deep sleep. And that's profound. I know it goes by pretty fast in English, but when you say twice as deep sleep, there's a profound restfulness, a restful alertness. That's profound. I mean, that's the reason why at 74 years old I was able to do 172 concerts last year.
Exactly. But that does anchor you, and it does – you at least know that's there for you once or twice a day when you need to go to it. And just like you said, you know, some members ventured off to drugs and alcohol and so forth, and that's what they look forward to provide them with relief. But this is obviously a much healthier choice, and it's something that again, it, you know, it's there every single day when you need to go to it.
Yes, it's been a blessing. It really has.
Yeah. Fast forward a little bit to the 80s, you lost one of the originals, the loss of Dennis.
That's right. Well, talk about lifestyle choices. You know, he was just, I mean, he would go into rehab for like an evening. But he was a rebellious person. I mean, I don't know. It was sad to see, because, you know, it was, on one hand, he was a great guy. On another other hand, he just got gripped by alcohol and drugs, you know. It's sad. I mean, but it happens. It happens to many families. And we're none of us completely untouched by it, because it affects an entire family, you know. And on a more national level, it affects a nation, you know. And so it's so sad. And that's why I'm so, you know,
focused on,
well, grateful to have the relief that comes through meditation. And, you know, so I only wish that my cousin had, you know, it's ironic that Dennis was the one that called us from Paris to say, Maharishi is going to teach us to meditate. And even when he was drunk, he would say, let's meditate.
Wow.
So he did know the value of it, but he couldn't overcome the addiction.
Did you think after the struggles with Brian, the loss of Dennis, and then the late 90s with the loss of Carl, that this was ever coming to an end? It was just you, Brian, and Al, or did you know you had to carry on? I mean, you're the iconic voice, and as long as you're there, I think that will always continue and happen. But did you ever think at a time that this wasn't going to continue?
No, because the music is immortal.
Yeah.
The music, I mean, it's amazing. You know, like, for instance, Full House. John Stamos is our good friend, and he sat us on Full House because he loves the Beach Boys.
That's right. He's toured with you guys. I forgot about that. Yeah.
He has, and he does on occasion when he's not busy doing what he does for a living, mainly. Mm-hmm. But so he's been a huge supporter of the Beach Boys, and by virtue of his having us on this show, we've been recognized by children, you know, year after year. I mean, so the Full House reruns, you never don't see Full House on the TV. I mean, it's always on.
True.
So, you know, something like that. I mean, the music just keeps being reinforced and introduced to successive generations, and so it's really special.
The Beach Boys, Mike Love. Mike, I can't tell you what a thrill it was to spend some time with you tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your program, this wonderful WGN rocks.
Thank you. I think so, too. I think so, too. All right, so it is 4:03. We're heading into the news. If you're just joining us, it is Father's Day Sunday, and my son Josh is joining us in the studio, as well as my nephew Ben, and my cousin Kev, who's also our pop culture historian. And we're hanging out through the whole show, but one of the reasons why I've got Ben and Josh doing sports is because Josh is a big part of the broadcasting team at Notre Dame High School. Ben is a big part of the broadcasting team at Barrington High School. Various things from producing to on air. And this is kind of a cool little opportunity, and they're going to be doing sports for the rest of the morning. Roger's been very kind to give them some time to do that. And Ben is coming up next with sports. But I know after that, Kevin and Ben are taking off. So, Kev, happy Father's Day to you.
Happy Father's Day to you, buddy.
And, Ben, thanks for being here, buddy.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me and my father.
Absolutely. Well,
and let's check sports with Ben Pokorny.
Thank you, Roger. The White Sox started out their weekend series against the Blue Jays with a 5-2 win in Toronto tonight. Mike Pelfrey went six innings on the mound and struck out five. Todd Frazier was able to chalk up his 11th home run of the season when he went deep in the second inning. The Northsiders faced off with their division rival Pittsburgh Pirates on the road. Jake Arrieta getting the start, also helping out on offense, hitting his first home run of the season in the second inning. But it was not enough to help the Cubbies' offense as they fell 4-3. To golf in the U.S. Open, Brian Harman is in the lead at 12 strokes under par, heading into the final round to play tomorrow at Erin Hills. Justin Thomas and others trail just one stroke behind him at 11 under. And Bears news, star running back Jordan Howard recently underwent laser eye surgery to upgrade his vision to 20/20. Howard will be ready in time for training camp in a few weeks, and he will be potentially looking at a second Pro Bowl season. Ben Pokorny, WGN Sports.
A child arrived just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away, and he was talking before I knew it. And as he grew, he'd say, I'm gonna be like you, Dad. You know I'm gonna be like you.
Good morning once again. It's Dave Player on this Father's Day morning here on 720 WGN. While most any man can father a child, there is so much more to the important role of being a dad in a child's life. Studies show that if a child's father is affectionate, supportive, and involved, he can contribute greatly to cognitive, language, and social development, as well as academic achievement. A strong inner core resource, sense of well-being, good self-esteem, and authenticity. And fathers are taking a more active role these days in child care than in previous generations. And to break it all down, we've invited Dr. Craig Garfield from Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Good morning, Dr. Garfield.
Good morning, Dave.
So society in general has been slow to realize the central role of fathers and have neglected sometimes to involve them in all aspects of the family-centered care. Why is that?
Well, I think that's old times, and that really dealt with an idea that dads really were just breadwinners for the family. When in reality, when we look at families today, most families are dual-earning families, so mom and dad both contribute to the bottom line.
Sure.
And when that happens, we have to then think about how dads can contribute at home more and be involved more in the child care that they actually look forward to doing.
Well, first, you know, dads and grandfathers of previous generations, where a lot of us got our examples from, there were different expectations of moms and dads. I mean, dads worked outside the home, as you said. Many moms worked inside the home. There was much more responsibility assumed by the mom, with the father having less involvement. Not the same in every home. My father was always involved when I was a kid, but, you know, studies in the last 10 years have shown that involvement of fathers has important consequences for a child's well-being, especially in regards to, you know, issues of behavior and happiness.
Yeah, there's no question now, Dave, that we have a better understanding than we ever have about the roles and the contributions that fathers have to their children. And that starts at the very, very beginning when dads are just talking to the baby through the womb. And the baby can hear that dad's voice. And when the baby comes out, will actually preferentially turn to the dad's voice compared to any other male voice out there. And that can be a magical moment for dads to realize that that influence even starts at the time of birth.
But even some dads, as an example, example. Like, you know, I have a friend that I said, hey, you know, I'm leaving work early today because I'm going to go see my child's performance at blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they may have said, really, you're going to that? Why, isn't your wife going? Like, you know, my dad never went to any of that stuff. Well, that's probably true, but that's changing.
Yeah, you bring up a really important point. I think one of the big shifts has been that men are wanting to be involved with their child, that they come at it with a different expectation than men from other generations, where they might have handed that off to the mom who might have been at home. Dad's now really come into becoming a father, looking to be involved and wanting to do the things that they maybe didn't have a chance to, they saw their dads didn't have a chance to do, or do something that they really look forward to, that they kind of come with their own expectations of being involved, and that might be attending plays, going to sporting games with them, mm-hmm. Really participating hands-on with that child.
You've noted that fathers usually talk to children in a way that's different than moms and exhibit a particular type of play. Dads change the rules. They explore a little bit more in a risky way but still keeping it safe. Those are two simple ways fathers involved with children help them grow, explore, and really help them learn about the world. It's a different relationship. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, dads play a real kind of, they can have a glue in the family. They can help, and their participation can help moms to manage and be better moms. They can get involved with the child and actually expand the language that the child is exposed to, expand the way that the play is done in the family, and really open the world to them. For many people, their first job actually comes from a connection that dad had in the workplace for them. So from baby all the way through the teenage years, dads play a really important role for these children.
Here's a bit of an alarming statistic. 5 years after a child's birth, 63% of unmarried fathers are no longer living with the mother. Even with married parents, that fathers may not attend appointments and milestones, as we talked about. 1 in 3 children, or approximately 15 million kids, live without their dad, according to the U.S. Census. And although a father might not live in the home, they have to find ways to stay involved, as it is critical to their well-being. But those are alarming statistics to me.
Yeah, absolutely. What the research has really started to show now is that even though dads may not be married, and it's, you know, about 40% of babies are born to unmarried couples, that dad is still there involved, oftentimes seeing the baby, if not every day, at least weekly. And dads can still contribute to the well-being of that child. They can help out by taking responsibility for certain parts of the child's life, by taking that child on outings, engaging that child in different ways than mom does, even if they're not married and even if they're not living together.
Now, in the last decade, a relatively new structure that has emerged in our culture, and we talked a little bit about this, is a stay-home dad. This is kind of growing daily, thanks in part to women's strong financial gain, the recent recession, increasing corporate layoffs, and men's emerging strong sense of self that they can handle this role while mom is at work.
Yeah, I think it's an exciting area. It's about, I think in 2016, there were 209,000 stay-at-home dads, and that number still has been high for a couple years. It's a really interesting part of the dad world that we're just learning a little bit more about. Some of it is due to the economics of who is out there in the workforce, and many times women will have advanced degrees, and so then it makes more sense for them to be in the workforce where they can get more money. But there's a number of dads that are out there that really want to do this. This is something that they look forward to doing. They're very committed to this role, to be that at-home dad.
I was looking at some statistics from when I was born in the late 1960s that typically a dad would watch the kids just a couple hours a week, and that's obviously more than tripled in recent years. And, you know, that kind of shows, you know, the growing force of a dad being involved. I can't tell you how many people, you know, I've talked to over time, you know, dad was loving, we got a great relationship, but wasn't as engaged and involved. And as we said, that's kind of the example of a lot of us, you know, grew up with, is that's how, what a dad's role is. But I think organically, that has just in a good way has changed and evolved.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Dave. I think back in the late 60s, they probably called that babysitting. Right. And nowadays, we would actually call it taking care of my kid. And I think dads really are looking forward to that. From the time that that their partner is pregnant, they already are having dreams and ideas about what that future is going to be like. And once that baby comes out, they're really ready and wanting to be engaged with that child from the get-go.
I had a friend of mine say in front of his wife and us, yeah, Friday night, no, I'll be home, I'll babysit. She said, you're not babysitting, I'm not paying you. This is your this is your job to be home. Children who are well bonded with their dads also tend, and you think about this, you know, there's issues in the classroom and kids misbehaving, that they tend to have less behavioral problems and somewhat, you know, inoculated against alcohol and drug abuse. Yet when fathers are less engaged, children are more likely to drop out of school and exhibit more issues. So, I mean, this is directly related to how these kids are growing up and their behavior.
Yeah, we're starting to understand a little bit more and more specifically how father's involvement actually is protective for children as they grow up in those areas of, you know, reduced delinquency, reduced depression, and social anxiety. And I think that's an important role for dads to play, is to actually be there, to be available to their child. It doesn't really take much in the way of money. You know, a lot of dads worry, can I afford this? How can I provide? But in reality, it gets down to the time that a dad can spend with the child, just listening, just talking, going for a walk, that's free. Reading to the child, that's free. And those are really important bonding moments for the child and the adult.
And here's one of the other things, the child's relationship with really dad or mom can affect, you know, all the child's relationships from birth till death, including those, you know, with friends, spouses, boyfriends, girlfriends, whatever. The importance of these relationships with the mom and the father specifically really affects all facets of life into adulthood and sets a pace on how they will raise their children.
Absolutely. The relationship that babies have and children have with their parents allows them then to feel secure in their ability to move out into the world and explore safely. Having that relationship with the dad is one way that babies do feel bonded and attached and then are safe to move into their environment and explore things. And if you look at any playground you know, across the U.S., you can see moms and dads that are out there. Moms watch their children in a little bit different way. They're a little bit more protective on the playground. Dads will still keep an eye on them, but they'll let them explore just a little bit further, take a little bit of a risk while they still keep an eye on them before they go out and kind of rein them in and bring them back into safety. And that exploration is part of what we think is one of the ways that dads contribute to advancing child development in a really unique way.
Terrific information, Dr. Craig Garfield from Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Thank you so much. I appreciate the chat.
Oh, thank you, Dave.
And happy Father's Day to you.
Happy Father's Day to you.
All right, it's 720 WGN. All right, Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So Elizabeth Diaz from Time Magazine has a feature story that caught my eye this week called The God Squad, the next generation of Catholic priests, young, energized, and ready to remake the Catholic Church. Now, the article notes a seismic shift that comes at a time when Pope Francis, who became the pontiff in 2013, calling for a new kind of priest to serve in the parishes around the world. For the first time in 30 years, the Vatican revised its global guidelines for educating priests and modeled it after Pope Francis's example of humility and vision for accessible and genuine leaders. Now, one of those leaders is someone I've gotten to know very well over the last year. He's my own pastor, the pastor of St. Juliana Parish in Chicago, and that's Father James Wallace, who joins us this morning. Good morning, Father James.
Good morning, Dave. Good to be with you.
Absolutely. Glad you're joining us. You know, looking at some of the recent statistics, the Catholic Church is facing an overall priest shortage in the U.S. The number of the priests in the country has dropped from 58,000 to 37,000 over the past 50 years. 3,500 parishes did not have their own parish pastor in 2016. In some places, there's shrinking attendance at masses. School populations are declining. And in Chicago, Cardinal Supich launched Renew My Church to look at the way we are serving our communities, to make improvements and make some tough decisions. But the bottom line is we can't keep doing what we're doing and expect to be successful or see any significant growth.
Right. We need to shake things up.
status quo just doesn't seem to be working. I don't know if it's ever worked, really. I mean, Jesus, from the very beginning, shook things up. And the church has always been known to kind of go to the peripheries, as Pope Francis says, and that's especially what we need to do today. And priesthood, in a special way, needs to do that. We need to be relatable. We need to be attractive. We need to reach people where they're at and just make Christ more appealing, simpler, and more exciting to be a Catholic now.
Well, you and Father Matt O'Donnell, two of the Archdiocese's youngest pastors, have been appointed to the Cardinals Renew My Church Committee. And the inspiration for this committee comes from Pope Francis, who has encouraged a shift. But he's telling, you know, we're telling church leaders to put their community first and avoid all the bureaucracy that maybe some priests get caught up in when really trying to figure out how to serve their parish.
Right. Bureaucracy, especially for young priests. So the article's on millennial priests, right? And I'm a millennial, 31 years old. Bureaucracy complexity is something that people my age, millennials, hate, right? Whether it's politics, the right. church, any sort of organization that has got a million moving parts and is confusing, we just walk away from, right? Instead of getting involved and trying to change it, we'll just go drink craft beers and grow out our beards and, you know, wear flannel mm-hmm. shirts, right? That's what millennials do. So the church is, it's confusing. It's complex. It strikes a bureaucracy and, I think that's one of the aspects of our parishes and our churches that we need to change, right? Get simpler, get to the core of what we're all about, and allow people to, you know, use their talents and their gifts to make the world a better place.
From the article, it says Wallace, the 31-year-old on Renew My Church team, calls himself socially progressive, but for him that means not being afraid to play ball with the kids, do a shot of Jameson with off-duty cops at a St. Patrick's Day party, or sit in the front lawn with a cigar and an extra lawn chair so people will come and talk. And you stated the big talk is evangelization. How do we go out and get people to really engage with the church? And we've launched at our parish our own campaign to engage more younger families, because there's a lot of younger families that are very engaged with the school, but not so many with the church itself. And that's really where all of this starts, is Sunday and going to church on the weekends.
Right. The Eucharist, we say, it's the source of all of our energy and the source of our happiness, of our peace. And from the Eucharist, from Sunday and the Mass, we should be able to go out throughout the week and make a difference, whether it's in school, whether it's at work, in the community. So it all starts at Mass.
But you talk about being, you know, your age and you're a millennial priest. One of the biggest issues is that the people who are attending Masses and are involved in the church are aging. And, you know, our baby boomers getting older every day. And what we're missing is really under 50 years old, under 40 years old, people involved with the parish. So really, you're not just talking about how you feel as a leader, as a millennial, on what you're able to do and how you're able to do it. But you're actually trying to talk to those people that are your age and within maybe a 20-year difference to engage them to come back. And even if they're involved in their kid's school, somehow come back and realize that church is the first place to start.
Right, right. And so how can we make parts of the Mass attractive or engaging or energizing to people? The way they're energized by things out in society, things that are attractive to them, how can we, you know, take those concepts and put them into the Mass, while not, you know, changing our fundamental structure and the body and blood of Christ. So that's what we need to look at, because people are just going to walk away like they've been walking away. So, and I feel like that's where maybe myself and other younger priests, you know, maybe can relate to the younger generation, whether it's by our language or our pop culture references or just being more approachable and present in a way that doesn't seem standoffish and preachy and dogmatic. That's what I'm just trying to do. Be an ordinary guy while being a priest.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, when I look at really this is, you know, because our audience that's listening now aren't all Catholics, but this is a systemic problem in every faith, in keeping people engaged with their faith and their community. And you've created this campaign called Experience Jesus, and it focuses on Sunday school and service. And it's really three core elements of the campaign. Explain a little bit of that.
Yeah, we want people to have the best experience possible, right? Everyone's always attracted to an experience, whether it's at Wrigley Field at a Cubs game or going to a Grateful Dead concert or seeing a movie, right? We like experiences. that, you know, allow us to forget about all of our anxieties and things outside the world. But we believe that Jesus Christ is the best experience you can have. And so we want people to experience Jesus in the most pure, best way possible. And we do that fundamentally on Sunday at Mass. And then from the Mass, it goes into our education, our knowledge school. And then from our knowledge of Christ, we serve the world. We make our brothers and sisters and our society a better place through our actions. It all starts with Jesus, Sunday school service. It's kind of this progression.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, change, though, and we know this, change can be difficult for some people. You know, people are very comfortable sometimes with status quo, regardless if, and I don't want to say the ship is sinking, but, you know, you don't want to be throwing out life jackets and looking at this at the back end. You want to be a little more proactive and figure out right now what to do. But to survive and thrive, you know, again, based in this Time magazine article, it is time for new thinking, thinking way outside the box, something that people aren't used to in the Catholic Church or any church for that matter. But it's necessary to reinvigorate our parishes.
It is. I mean, we always need to be evolving and adapting. I mean, the world is a complex place, and there's things that are happening. And the church, you know, we believe we have fundamental things in place that are going to help us. But outside of those fundamental things, we can adapt, and we can make ourselves, like I said, simpler and more attractive. And it's nothing new in a way. Like, Christ changed the culture that he came out of. He changed part of his Jewish tradition, right, so that people could experience God and experience his mercy. And we need to do the same thing 2,000 years later.
And by the way, engaging these younger families also sets a great example for children, too, because kids really do respect and appreciate when they see their parents involved in their community.
Absolutely, right? And that's how, I mean, Cardinal Supich is really trying to make Chicago a more peaceful, holy place, right? He's got his peace in this, you this. And peace really starts with the family. And the family is grounded in peace and holiness when the parents are good examples and the children can follow them. And they then radiate that peace and that charity to their neighbors, and then it just flows from there. So the parents, we need to get them to be well-grounded, rooted in Jesus Christ, and then their children will be inspired by that, and they'll follow suit, and then so will our city.
Well, again, this is a great article in Time magazine. It's called The God Squad, The Next Generation of Catholic Priests, Young, Energized, and Ready to Remake the Catholic Church. Father James is featured in there as well. You can find it on newsstands. You could also download it at time.com. Father James Wallace from St. Juliana, thank you for taking some time with us this morning.
Thank you, David. Be well. God bless.
Thank you. Same to you, sir. All right, top stories are next on 720 WGN.
Checking WGN Sports, our last sportscast of the morning, I guess. Josh Plyer.
Thanks, Roger. The Cubs fell in Pittsburgh 4-3. Jake Arrieta took the loss despite striking out seven Pirates. Arrieta also cranked a two-run bomb at the plate. Addison Russell hit his sixth homer. Cubs will finish their three-game series today in Pittsburgh at 12:35 p.m. The White Sox won their second series game against the Toronto Blue Jays yesterday by a score of 5-2. Todd Frazier, Matt Davison, and Jose Abreu each hit solo homers in the game. Right-hander Mike Pelfrey picked up the victory after allowing just one run on four hits with no walks over six innings. Sox will finish their three-game series today in Toronto at 12:07 p.m. After three rounds at the U.S. Open today, Brian Harman is the leader at 12 under par. Justin Thomas, Brooks Koepka, and Tommy Fleetwood are all one shot back. A blockbuster trade is being finalized in the NBA. Multiple reports say the Celtics will trade the number one overall pick in next week's draft to Philadelphia. The Sixers are expected to select point guard Markelle Fultz. Josh Plyer, WGN Sports.
Hey, Luke, may the force be with you.
It was you, Kristen, who shot J.R.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
We're not gay.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
John, I've been waiting a long time to take the reins.
My name is Dave Letterman. Last night, I became a father. Thank you very much.
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
For the third time in 6 seasons, it's one gone cheese.
And now, this is history.
You're going to need a standing host.
With Dave Plyer.
It's a guy, but I love you.
And Dave Schwann on 720 WGN.
And good morning on this Father's Day Sunday. Dave and Josh Plyer. That's the way to do it. Father and son this morning all night long. And in for Dave Schwann. And this is history. Is a history buff himself, Mr. Roger Banish. Good morning to you.
Hi, I feel very exalted to be here.
You've hung around for some of these, though.
That's yeah, I have. Absolutely. I sit in the back and laugh at you guys.
You do. You always do. We have, let's see here, there's some very interesting little things. I've got some nice little clips for you today that I know you'll get a kick out of. 1868, President Andrew Johnson passes a law that government workers should work 8 hours a day.
That's pretty good.
It's about time.
But what were some of them doing? Like, you know, when I come in for coffee and then work for 5 minutes. And
there were 12, 10-hour work days.
Oh, they were longer. Okay.
Yeah. The 8-hour work day quickly became a central demand of the Chicago labor movement. The Illinois legislature, passed a law in early 1867 granting an 8-hour day. But it had so many loopholes that it was largely ineffective. A citywide strike that began on May 1st, 1867, shut down the city's economy for a week before collapsing. And June 25th, Congress passed an 8-hour work day for federal employees, which is also of limited effectiveness. So that was it. 1860, all the way back then.
Yeah.
All the way back then. 1910, the first ever Father's Day, celebrated for the first time in Spokane, Washington, the YMCA in 1910. By Sonora Smart Dodd, who was born in Arkansas. Its first celebration was at the Spokane YMCA. Her father, the Civil War veteran William Jackson Smart, was a single parent who raised his 6 children there. And after hearing a sermon about Jarvis's Mother's Day in 1909, she told her pastor that fathers should have a similar holiday honoring them. And although she initially suggested June 5th, her father's birthday, the pastors did not have enough time to prepare their sermons, and the celebration was deferred to the third Sunday in June.
Oh, all right. So Mother's Day came first.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, well, of course.
Ladies first.
Yeah, ladies first.
Of course. All right. 1917, Raggedy Ann is invented. It is a character created by American writer Johnny Gruhl in a series of books he wrote and illustrated for young children. It's a rag doll, of course. But yeah. There's a story. He created it for his daughter, Marcella, when she brought him an old handmade rag doll, and he drew a face on it. And from the bookshelf, he pulled up a book of poems and combined the names of the two poems, The Raggedy Man and Little Orphan Annie. Now, Marcella died at the age of 13 shortly after being vaccinated for smallpox. So becoming a opponent of the vaccination, his father and the Raggedy Ann doll was used as a symbol of the anti-vaccination movement.
Wow.
That's where Raggedy Ann came from.
That hall has been lost in history.
Yeah, right? Let's take a listen to a classic Raggedy Ann commercial.
Pencils broken, paper's floating, what's the date and day? Raggedy Ann and Andy are ready right away. Batteries are not included, sharpened stencils neat. Staple, staple, papers, papers, push the desk, repeat. Raggedy Ann and Andy blocks show the day and date. Raggedy Ann and Andy set can be a fun workmate.
The Raggedy Ann and Andy.
That must have been the late 70s, maybe, early 80s.
Yeah.
I couldn't find one much older than that one.
Yeah, and I wonder when Andy came along.
Yeah. And Raggedy and Andy, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure some marketing ploy.
Oh, of course, especially the way that Raggedy Ann began, the purpose behind it, as some marketing genius got a hold of it.
Right.
And they figured out, hey, we can make some money at this.
That's right.
Yeah, how do we expand? That's interesting.
1933, Don McNeil's Pepper Pot, which was also then called the Breakfast Club.
Breakfast Club. Yeah, I loved listening to it when I in the 60s.
35 and a half years on NBC.
Yeah.
Crazy. Longest-running morning variety show on the NBC Blue and ABC radio network. A little bit on television, too.
Mm-hmm.
Originated in Chicago, hosted by Don McNeil from 1933 to 1968. His 35-and-a-half-year run as host, McNeil, remains the longest tenure for an MC of a network entertainment program, surpassing Carson and Bob Barker.
Look at that.
Let's take a little listen to a classic. And these aren't very much available, these audio clips, but let's take a listen.
Presenting America's favorite, the Blue Network Breakfast Club with Don McNeil.
Good morning, Breakfast Club. Good morning to you. We got up bright and early, just a howdy to you. The coffee's on, the table set, there's bacon in the skillet. And Harry Cogan and his boys have fumed the village. So come on, gang, and gather around. We'll start this meeting. Just line up here, I'll call your name.
And this was the destination show of its day. I mean, this is the WGN Morning News of its day. It really
was. Exactly.
Yeah.
There was the march around the breakfast table.
Yes. Yes.
I loved listening to that thing.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Yeah.
1940 Batman comics. Mobsters rubbed out a circus high wire team known as the Flying Graysons, leaving their son Dick an orphan, thus the introduction of Robin. And of course, his ward. And so there was a really good point that Batman, Adams West Batman, you know, obviously became,
Bruce Wayne was
father.
A father. Yeah.
He was a father.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both orphans.
Yeah. Yeah. Both of them.
Because if you think about it, in the comics, there was no, aunt. It was just the butlers.
That's right.
And Batman.
That's right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
1949, Captain Video and his Video Rangers debut on Dumont TV. Let's take a listen.
Post. P-O-S-T. P-O-S-T. The cereals you like the most. The cereals made by Post. Take you to the secret mountain retreat of Captain Video. Electronic wizard, master of time and space, guardian of the safety of the world. Fighting for law and order, Captain Video operates from a mountain retreat with secret agents all over the globe. Possessing scientific secrets and weapons.
So this was a kiddie program, but it's also kind of science fiction. But this was the big kiddie program of its day. But the clip that I remember best of any reference to Captain Video is what, Roger?
Oh, my God. Now you're putting me on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
Captain Video.
Captain Video and his Video Rangers. Come on. You're close. I know
God,
you got it.
You just threw me. You just threw me when you did that.
The first official 39 Honeymooners episodes was Ralph Gets
When
ATV.
He dressed up.
And he watched Captain Video and his Video Rangers. Let's take a listen.
Attention, Rangers! I want all you Rangers at home to recite the Captain Video Ranger pledge. I, Edward Morton, Ranger, third class in the Captain Video Space Academy, do solemnly pledge to obey my mommy and daddy. Be kind to dumb animals and old ladies in and out of space. Not to tease my little brothers and sisters. And to brush my teeth twice a day and drink milk after every meal.
All right, that's it.
That's it. Yeah, right, smack.
See, now, that's one thing that with all the, and I say this because I've seen it on Nickelodeon and Disney, all my kids, you know, the shows that are on those networks are awful.
Oh, there's nothing good now.
But I mean,
no way.
But the sitcoms are so substandard.
Because they weren't set to a certain time. They're
just churning
them
out.
Evergreen.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
you know what I'm
awful.
Saying?
They're absolutely awful. But I do, you know, my kids, and I've done it with all of them, is I've introduced them to the classics. So every summer, we watch something classic. And Honeymooners, of course, you've seen.
Honeymooners, past couple of years, we did Brady Bunch, we did Dick Van Dyke, we did Carol Burnett, we did, what else did we do?
Genie.
We did Genie.
Happy Days.
We did Bewitched.
Lucy. Some Lucy in there, too. Yep. The Fugitive.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I let them watch the classics because I would rather have them watch that all day long.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Than the garbage that's on TV now, of course. 1955, the first automobile seatbelt legislation was enacted. It was acted in right here in Illinois. First state to require it. Seatbelts were a must.
Darn.
Although I remember my grandmother in her 59 Chevy Impala, her seatbelt was putting her hand in front of me.
That's every parent's seatbelt. Are you kidding?
But there was no seatbelt. Well, so that was going to stop me flying through the window.
Of course.
Hand. Yeah.
As she went flying through the window.
Exactly. When I said shotgun, my dad's arm is my airbag.
That's right. Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, I still do that. I did do that even with the kids in seatbelts.
I should have pulled the clip on this. Stop short.
That's
from Seinfeld. I should have done that. 77, Elvis Presley. Oh, I'm sorry, 65. First U.S. ground combat forces in Vietnam authorized by President Johnson. Let's take a listen to his presidential news conference.
This is a different kind of war. There are no marching armies or solemn declarations. Some citizens of South Vietnam, at times with understandable grievances, have joined in the attack on their own government. But we must not let this mask a central fact that this is really war. It is guided by North Vietnam and it is spurred by Communist China. Its goal is to conquer the South, to defeat American power, and to extend the Asiatic dominion of communism.
And that is 1965.
Yeah, but he was not the first to send.
No.
Because Kennedy, before that.
Correct.
Was sending advisors. They didn't send ground troops. They sent advisors so that we can get around. Because, you know, only Congress can declare war.
Right.
So in order to do that and push the American agenda overseas, we sent advisors and some equipment to help those advisors. Well, the equipment were planes or helicopters or flamethrowers or whatever, and the advisors were going out in combat with the Vietnamese to do battle south against the North.
Yeah, Kennedy is the one that dipped his toe, American toe, into Vietnam.
And originally it was a battle for the French.
Oh, that's right.
The French government.
I remember that. Yeah,
was
that's
the,
right.
the first. Yeah.
Wow. That is 1965. Later, 1977, Elvis Presley sings in Indianapolis, his last performance of his career. He died on August 17th, less than 2 months later. And that's one of the first big news stories I remember as a kid. I was like 10 years old at the time. But I remember that moment. 1980 and 1993, respectively, the David Letterman Show debuts, his short-lived daytime talk show on NBC long before Late Night. And 1993, Late Night with David Letterman aired for the last time on NBC TV. Do you remember who his last guest was before he moved to CBS?
His last guest was his first guest.
It was Bill Murray.
Yeah.
But it was also the last guest on the last Letterman show on NBC was Bruce Springsteen. Sang Glory Days.
Yeah.
That was awesome. Yeah. It was a classic episode. My error, Elvis died on the 16th of August. I said the 17th.
Mm-hmm. I was in Vegas when that happened.
Is that right? Oh, yeah, living out in Vegas.
Because it was late 70s. 70, what'd you say, 77?
Mm-hmm. 77.
Yeah. But we were in Vegas already.
Josh Plyer has been with me all night. That is my son. It's kind of been a tradition to hang out on Father's Day all night long. I appreciate you staying up.
Thank you, Dad. Happy Father's Day.
Thank you, buddy. I appreciate that. Love you. And your brother and sister, too young to be up all night long.
Oh, yeah.
So love them, too. I'm a lucky dad, so thank you for that. Happy Father's Day to my father, Roger, to you as well.
Bless you. Thank you, sir.
And to all of you out there as well. And Camille, fabulous job.
Yes.
Thank you. Very it was nice. So much fun.
It was a blast.
I enjoyed it. It was great.
Me too. And what was that? Round of applause. Ooh, we got a round of applause from the high school guy. Look at that.
There
okay, very cool.